I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Frank Forensich. Frank Forensich is a biocentric guy trying to make a go of it in an anthropocentric culture. He studied human biology, martial art, and traveled to Africa to experience the human ancestral environment. He's the author of several books about health and the human predicament, including The Sapiens Curriculum and Beware Feral's Tigers. So, a few things. First off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program. And third, last time we especially talked about beware false tigers, but there's two other words that are sort of snuck into this bio that I want to emphasize today, which is martial arts. And so first, can you introduce people to your work in general in case they haven't read your work, which is unfortunate, or in case they didn't hear our last interview? And then second, can you sort of move us into the discussion of the relationship between your work, activism, and martial arts?
Right. Yes. Just delighted to be here with you and talking about these themes. They're so exciting to me. But yeah, origin story and background to review. I had a lot of health problems when I was a kid, and then I got involved in swimming and exercise in high school, and it totally transformed my body, and I became kind of an evangelist for physical movement and really interested in the body. And so as an undergraduate, I had a professor in human biology who said, if you really want to understand the body, you should go to Africa and study human evolution, which I did. And at the same time, I was going to the dojo every night and I was studying the martial arts, and I was completely turned on, captivated by that experience. And those two lines of inquiry really kind of wove into what I write about. And I've always been interested in health and the body and the human predicament. And of course, growing up in California and hearing the story of John Muir and these efforts to save wild places, that also resonated with me and led me to write about these themes. So that's kind of the history here. And the martial arts is a wonderful launching point for inquiry, because there's so much diversity in that world and so many amazing teachers and so many interesting ideas floating around that world that it's a real fertile area of inquiry.
So there's a few directions I'm thinking. One is, the first place I would like to go is, can you hone in just a little bit more on your work in general about the relationship between the fact that we are living in this technologized society and we are not always in our bodies, mm-hmm. and bring nature into that discussion too. Can you give just a couple more minute introduction to your work in general?
Sure. Well, one of the foundational ideas is what a lot of people are calling mismatch now. And so we've got these ancient bodies, these aboriginal bodies, and these ancient ways of knowing and understanding the world. And now the modern world has come to be in such an instantaneous way, the blink of an eye, that we aren't really prepared to live in this world. And some people have managed to adapt, but many, many people are having tremendous struggles adapting to this modern world. And I think that a lot of the scholarship about how to know the world and our relationship to the world basically leapfrogs over our history and leapfrogs over the body. And that's a real tragedy. We're being thrust into this world of abstractions, technology, concepts, pigeonholes, boilerplate, templates, all of these things that take away from our primal ways of knowing the world. And this leapfrogging over the body is a catastrophe for our health and our sense of belonging and participation in the world. So we're like these free floating organisms now that really aren't participating in the wider circle of life. And this, of course, is something that Native people have been talking about for a long time, but it's becoming something that we can no longer ignore. And it has personal consequences, but it also has widespread consequences for the future. And so that has this disconnect between our animal nature and our predicament in the modern world. That's in many ways the defining issue of our time.
I know this isn't precisely what you're talking about, but it makes me think of a couple of polls that I've seen over the last few years. One of them was that young people in the UK, they were asked if they had a choice between being deprived of Wi-Fi or sunlight. They said they would prefer to be deprived of sunlight.
Right, I've heard those.
And the other one was, I think, even more horrifying, which is they said if you were given a choice between having someone take your cell phone and having someone cut off one of your fingers, which would you choose? And they said that more of them would prefer to lose the finger than the cell phone.
Right. Yes, I've heard these things. And it also shows up on online dating websites, where one of the questions often is, what is the most important thing to you in the world? And a lot of people list their phone. And it's just an unbelievable tragedy and a failure to appreciate priorities and fundamentals of living. So yeah, that's a reflection of how far we've come away from our origins.
Okay, so does that seem like a nice place to segue into martial arts? Because before we start, true confession, the only martial art that I have done is I did some informal boxing when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And also another true confession, that I used to think that the MMA that you can see on TV was simply people beating the crap out of each other. But a friend of mine who is herself a kickboxer said to me, no, this is chess at 100 miles an hour. And it transformed my perspective of, and I know you weren't specifically talking about the, you know, people going in and elbowing each other in the face, but it transformed my understanding of that from simply sort of, I don't know how you say this, uneducated brawling to to something that is a definite, extraordinary skill set and connection to one's body. So I've gotten myself out of the way. Now you can say whatever you want about martial arts.
Right. Well, I guess a little more history here. My personal experience, I spent about 10 years studying karate, and this was basically at a shopping mall dojo. And then I spent another 10 years studying Aikido, which is a very different martial art. And again, that points to the diversity of teachers and ideas in that world. And it, of course, it includes everything from things that are very spiritual all the way to things that are very much oriented toward practical street fighting. But what I'm trying to do is make that experience in the martial arts relevant to the challenges that we're facing on the ground today. For example, the chances of getting attacked on the street are pretty low for most people, but we have this unbelievable eco-social crisis. So is there something that martial artistry can teach us about activism in the larger world? And I think that there is. That a lot of the metaphors that we can draw from the martial arts are valuable in other domains. One thing to keep in mind is that the traditional martial arts came from a different world, a world where combat on the battlefield was a reality, especially in Japan. You would often be called upon to do battle on the battlefield. That's a different set of challenges than we face today. So are there lessons we can learn from the martial arts? And I think there are. So we can dig into those.
Yeah, I would love to dig into those, but there's one more thing I want to do before we go there, which is, since, you know, you didn't say this, but one of the predicaments, you called it a mismatch, I believe, mm-hmm. but I would say that we are in many ways, for many reasons, out of our bodies much of the time.
Right.
And that can happen through trauma, abuse. It can happen through technology where it just, quote, is more interesting, end quote, to be watching a movie rather than it being in your own life or something. So can you talk for a moment before we get to the actual ways that it can be used as metaphors, et cetera? Can you talk about the importance of any athletics and especially martial arts for simply centering oneself back in one's body?
Right. And as somebody who's practiced several different movement arts, I think it's all good. All the sports are good. All the dance is good. All of this is good, especially when we put the emphasis on the experience of being in your body. And the problem is that these creeping distractions that have come in from so many different directions to dilute that experience, and sports now being mostly about winning and not about the experience of being in your body, or people bringing electronic devices into the physical training experience. That's another dilution there. But the traditional martial arts placed a lot of emphasis on being in your body. And that's one important value right at the outset there.
You know, I guess a couple of things, and I'll drop this in a moment, but it's some things that really struck me, which is, you know, my primary way of being athletic in college was as a high jumper. And one of the things I've said about high jumping since is if you think you're going to make a jump, you won't, because your mind is still working, and what you're wanting to do is to so fully be present that, I mean, this sounds really cosmic, and I don't mean it cosmically at all, that there is no jump. I mean, there's just you and the movement. And a couple more things about that. One is, you know, it's routine at the end of football games to ice the kicker, to make them think. And it's the same in basketball. You ice the free throw shooter. And I remember one announcer one time who'd been a coach for many years saying that when the game is on the line and somebody's shooting at the free throw line, that he really wants, what he wants more than anything, yeah, of course, a good free throw shooter, but what he really wants is somebody who's not going to overthink it, and somebody who just will go up and shoot just like they were shooting in practice, and they don't let their mind get in the way. So can we talk for just a moment about, and I've never done martial arts, but I've heard they're really good for this, about helping to, and I don't want to dismiss the mind, but please help me, mm-hmm. please answer the waffling, ridiculous question I'm asking.
No, this makes perfect sense, because one of the great classic books in the world of martial artistry is Zen and the Art of Archery. And in that, there's a lot of talk about relinquishing your attachment to the destination, to scoring a bullseye. It's more about the experience. It's more about the journey. It's more about how you feel when you're in flow of doing that activity. And so once again, you know, we put so much emphasis on the outcome, but here we're talking about putting more of the emphasis on the experience of being in your body. And even if you miss the target, it doesn't matter. It's how well you are. Well, the snowboard people talk about being tight loose. And that is, I think, a great description of how you want to feel when you engage in one of these high pressure experiences. You're kind of tight loose, you're kind of strong a little bit, but you're loose as well. So yes, it's that journey moment that's so important.
Well, sorry, I keep putting off getting to the metaphors, but I'm thinking also of, you know, what I was saying about how if you think you're going to make it, you won't, because you need to be so fully present. But also, like I said earlier, that the friend convinced me or helped me understand MMA in a different way when they said it's chess at 100 miles an hour, because if you're like in actual combat, I don't think that you would have time, like people shooting at you or people. This is why they train so much. And this is the same in basketball. If you're actually with 2 seconds left in a game, you can't really think, okay, I'm going to fake left, then move right, and then do a step back. You have to, your body has to know it. And I mean, that's the whole point of exercise, or the whole point of practice, is to turn it into body memory. And right. So go ahead.
To allow the animal to take over.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And that's what we see when we go to the dog park, right? The dog is not thinking about, you know, which foot he's going to use. He's allowing his deep body to do the process on its own. And that's the purity of the experience and the purity of the movement he's after. So, yeah.
Okay. So let's move on to what you really wanted to talk about. And
well, I would jump in with a little bit more background, and I would invite your listeners to think of their early experience. If you grew up in a typical family, typical American family, there's a good chance that your mother told you don't fight, but your father told you don't lose. And that simplistic advice amounts to what was our martial education. We were taught about fighting in those two sentences, and that was it. And when you think about how much conflict there really is in a typical human life, that's not even approaching adequate. We basically don't teach one another about conflict. We don't have a conflict curriculum. We don't have education for fighting, how to be a better fighter. And this is like a black hole. This is a big empty space in our curriculum, in our whole human curriculum. And it's a tragedy right there. And we see it reflected in the quote unquote activism in the modern world, because we see people who are trying to change the world and doing a really poor job of it. So the problem is not fighting itself. The problem is poor thought about fighting, unskillful fighting, awkward fighting, ill-conceived fighting. And if people were a little bit more educated about how to be a martial artist or about martial artistry, that things would be a lot better.
So I want you to explore that more. But before we go there, I'm thinking also just in personal relationships as opposed to larger social issues, mm-hmm. that one of the most important aspects or characteristics of someone with whom I'm going to be in any sort of relationship is that I want them to fight fair.
Mm-hmm.
That I would rather be with somebody who was not very smart and with whom I did not share politics and was all sorts of other things. If that person fought fair, I would rather be with that person than somebody who was smart and amazing in every other way, except in interpersonal relationships, they fought dirty. And my point, I think, is that, and this is a separate issue from the other, is that I mean, when I look back on my romantic relationships, I just think about how much, how different it was to have a conflict with somebody who was capable of doing a fair conflict than it was to, we get in a conflict and all of a sudden they're doing ad hominems and doing, you know, all of a sudden they're calling me names instead of saying, you know, when this particular thing happened, it made me feel bad. So can we talk about that behavior right then?
Right. And this is why you see in traditional cultures, whether it be traditional martial art cultures or native and indigenous cultures, you see so much emphasis on qualities like honor and integrity and respect. And that's built in, that's woven into the system. And so what these tribal elders are saying is, yes, fight fair, fight with integrity. The fighting itself is not the problem. It's how we do it. And so when we have these elders leading the way on this, then people are more likely to take a stance of truthfulness and to step up in a way that maybe is conflicted, but is honorable of the opponent and honorable of the system that you're operating in. So the traditional ways are better. You know,
this makes me think of another thing that I've noticed over the years, that certain institutions will have an institutional personality. Mm-hmm. And I specifically remember there were two different hospitals I was at. One of them where it seemed everybody was crabby, and everybody from the front desk to the technicians to everybody, they were kind of mean. And yeah. I was at a different hospital, a different time. And like, as they're wheeling me in for surgery, you know, like I remember specifically one of the janitors like looked at me and smiled and said hi. And at every level, it was different. So and this one more part to the story before I get to the point, which is years ago, I attended I was asked to be at a Patagonia company, the Patagonia company board meeting. And my experience that day was just the same thing, that everybody there was really nice and dedicated and everything. And I had a chance to talk to an HR person, which I rarely do. And so I brought up this exact point I'm making right now. And I said, how do you create an entire institution that consists of, I mean, a nice institution as opposed to a not nice institution? And they said, it's all in the hiring, because when you bring people in, they said, we're actually more interested in them being a good person who has the skills that you're talking, that you, Frank, are talking about right now. We're more interested in that than we are their technical qualifications. And so my point is that at least certain institutions recognize the importance of that ability to have some sort of conflict without it turning into a brawl.
Right.
And that affects the entire institution/organization. I'm just emphasizing the importance of what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's reflected in the organizational culture, because all of these things that happen in a social system are contagious. And in a sense, the whole system is balanced on individual actions and individual values. So if you can promote those values of honor, integrity, and respect, those traditional values, your organization is probably going to work better.
So we're about a little under halfway through the interview. So now that we've done this long introduction, I would like for you to really take off with the relationship between martial arts and activism. You know, you hinted at it, and then I pulled you back from that. So I would like for you to jump in now.
Right. Well, just starting with the word activism, you look back just a couple of generations, at least in American culture, and you never heard that word. You never heard people referring to themselves as activists. And now you hear the word a lot. A lot of people are trying to change the world in one way or another. And once again, that's another area where we don't have an educational base. There is rarely any training for how to be a better activist. And that's another thing that's reflected in the world. So I look at people all across the political spectrum now who are trying to make a difference. They're trying to make a change. And for example, you look at the January 6th incident, and those are people who were trying to make a difference. Was that an example of martial artistry? I would say no. And we can talk about that at length. Or the trucker convoy in Ottawa recently, was that an example of martial artistry? I would say no, and we can talk about that as well. So we can look at all these instances of people trying to change the world Was it artfully done, or was it reactionary and impulsive? And these are the conversations we need to have going forward. Is our activism effective? And does it work? Does it preserve the qualities that we're looking to preserve?
So be more specific with, does it work to preserve the quality? Or let's take a case study of, Let's say there is somebody who loves. So, name a species you love, or species or a place, whatever.
Okay, marine mammals I love.
Okay, so let's say that. Just to take the first thing that comes to mind, let's say that one wants to reduce or eliminate whaling. Can we do that one?
Sure, and we could talk about Captain Paul Watson too.
So what would be an example of? I would like to have two examples. Examples work really well for me. So what would be an example and why of something being done using what you're talking about of martial arts? And what would be? It could be a hypothetical example too. What would be an example of somebody not?
Well,
I'm trying to get at. What do you mean by something being, you know, having this martial artistry? So what would be one that does, and what would be one that doesn't? They can both be theoretical, whatever. I don't care.
Okay. Well, I would compare something from our world. We might talk about the Monkey Wrench Gang, and we might talk about George Washington Hayduke, who goes around destroying, vandalizing bulldozers and other construction equipment. And we might wonder, is that something that you do to feel good, or is it actually effective in creating change? And the answer, I think, is it probably makes him or us feel good to read about and to think about and maybe participate in those kind of activities. But does it make more enemies? How does it change? Does it really stop logging and deforestation to vandalize bulldozers? And the answer, I think, is maybe no, because then you're going to create more enemies, and these people have insurance, and these people are going to enact more security. And so maybe the systemic effect is negative in the law. Maybe it makes more sense to protest. Maybe it makes more sense to go to law school. These things are hard to measure. You don't know for sure, but the point is you need to think about the long term and the systemic consequences of your actions. And that's something that we don't do enough of.
So I'm thinking of, so that has to do with effectiveness and simply thinking strategically.
Right.
And so what's the difference between somebody thinking strategically? Where do the martial arts fit into this? Or is thinking strategically part of the martial arts, I don't know, ethos or whatever word we want to use, worldview?
Right. And this is something that you hear in a lot of dojos around the world, is the teacher will present some combative hand-to-hand technique, and the students will practice that. And then quite often the teacher will say, well, now this is something to think about when you do your practice off the mat. So now you're outside of the dojo, you're living in the world, and you're trying to take some of those same qualities that you're developing in a hand-to-hand environment out into the larger world. So maybe it's your athleticism, or it's your sensitivity, or it's your grace under pressure. These kinds of things can all be applied in the larger world off the mat. And that's what we're so often not seeing in the world of politics, and you might say blunt force activism that's out there now.
So I think that what you're saying about the thinking about acting strategically is really, I don't think that we can underscore how important that is. And, you know, I have spoken with so many activists who, I mean, there's a famous line by David Brower that all of our environmental victories are temporary and all of our losses are permanent. And Thomas Lindsay talks about how, you know, what he has sort of effectively done through what he did through his first years of activism was basically teach the destroyers how to write better documents, because mm-hmm. they would put out a document that's going to support their factory hog farm, and he and the community would fight it, and they would stop them. And instead of actually stopping the hog farm, all they do is they come back and they make a better document that's more airtight.
Right, right. I've heard that one.
And so it's thinking strategically, you know, what are we actually accomplishing is, I think, really important. But I think there's more to the martial arts activism connection than I've let you say so far.
Right. Well, everything's contagious, and everything is bigger than we think it is. And getting back to marine mammals and Paul Watson and this sort of thing, looking at his activism where he goes out and tries to interfere with whaling operations, that he does it according to a certain code. And that code is important, and it guides his actions, and that itself is contagious to other people. So he can be an inspiration. Not all of us can get a ship and go out on the high seas and do this kind of thing. But the tone, the flavor of what he brings, the courage that he brings to these encounters is actually really important for all of us. And so he's thinking strategically, he's thinking long-term, he's thinking systemically as well. So that I would call a form of martial artistry.
So I'm thinking about Hey Duke, and mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I agree with you that that simple vandalism is not generally particularly effective at larger social change. But I'm wondering if we could put Hey Duke in a framework of a beginning martial artist, or mm-hmm. a beginning, somebody who's just beginning, and the first step. So people who are, okay, I don't know if I'm going to get this correctly, but you know, part of being out of one's body is being out of touch with one's emotions,
right?
And that can include being out of touch with one's outrage, which, when one is out of touch with one's outrage, one can either not feel outrage when one actually mm-hmm. does, and then that outrage can sometimes come out in ways. Okay, this is a great example that I was when I was a high jumper. Okay, up until then, you know, my father's very abusive. I had bottled in all my emotions. And when I was a high jumper, if I would miss a jump I was supposed to make, I would throw a tantrum. And my coach would say, gosh, Derek, real athletes don't need to, you know, throw their shoes across the field and, you know, jump up and down and basically act like a toddler. And what he didn't understand is that sort of developmentally, I was actually really glad to be showing an emotion, no matter how unseemly. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if we can see Hey Duke as perhaps sort of an immature stage So first they're feeling it, and they're not really thinking their way through it.
Right. Right.
And they're just sort of spewing. And then the next step would be to, okay, that's nice that you had your little tantrum. Now let's move on to using that energy. I was thinking, so is the dojo the person in charge, or is that the place?
That's the place.
Okay, so if you're the sensei, right. So could you see this movement as a young person coming in who, like, is, can you see what I'm getting at with this?
Oh, totally. Yeah, and that's a wonderful thought experiment. It's like, okay, we're at the dojo, and the young Hey Duke comes in, and he's a white belt, and he's just starting to train, and he's totally outraged by all kinds of things, especially the destruction of the natural world. And so what can the sensei offer him? And I think the sensei can offer an experience that will help him channel his emotion into maybe a more effective and productive way, and to through training on the mat, come to a state of equilibrium where he can be more creative in his activism. And that's, boy, we could do a lot right there. But
well, I'm thinking that this actually, I think this is huge, because like my friend George Straffen said that he helped bring Earth First to Washington State back in the early 80s, because it was filled with people who were outraged at what was happening to the forest, and he really liked that. Right. But then he quit in the mid to late 80s because it had pretty much been taken over by people who were outraged and who had an excuse to manifest their outrage, which is an entirely different thing.
Right. Right. No, there's got to be training for the young activists. You can't just fire them up and let them go. There has to be some training to take that energy and channel it.
And which is what I see. And this takes us back to January 6th. And this takes us back to, frankly, a lot of the protests that have been happening over the last several years, is I see a lot of anger. And I mean, we have the line from Network from the 70s, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And we have people manifesting that. But again, I see a lot of it is being used basically to, I don't see a lot of intelligent target selection. I don't see a lot of maturity in the movement.
Right. And this is what fascinates me about somebody like Greta Thunberg, because I think a lot of us have appreciated her willingness to speak out and her passion and her moral clarity about what's happening on the planet. I think it's great. I've heard her speak recently where I thought that maybe her anger went a little bit too far and maybe alienated too many people. So she would be a really interesting person to work with as well. And, you know, we could harness that energy and maybe direct it in precisely the right way. And that's another theme, I think, that comes up in the martial art, in the hand-to-hand world, is precision. You know, you're going to strike your opponent, but only use the minimum force required. Do the job as necessary, but don't do more than that.
So I know that there will be at least a few listeners who will generically object to martial language, and I'm not one of them, but I know that I know this because I've gotten this complaint in my books a lot. It's like, you can't talk about military metaphors. You can't talk about, and I disagree with that, but help me defend the fact that we're talking about martial arts.
Right. Well, it's impossible to avoid fighting. I mean, you can adopt a pacifist stance, and people are welcome to do that if they want to, and they're entitled to become victims if they're ever attacked. But you can never take that stance if one of your loved ones is under attack, or somebody who's close to you is under attack, or if habitat is under attack. Then you can no longer assume that pacifist stance. It's just not morally tenable. So, yeah, I think the martial metaphors and the martial language, I think fighting is inevitable on this planet for our species. And the only real solution is to do it well. And, you know, I would stand by that statement.
So what does it look like to do that well? I think you've mentioned effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And I say this also, I have, ever since I was a child, I've read boatloads of military history. And, you know, everything you're saying applies on that level too, you know, thinking strategically. You know, it's, you know, good on you, I guess, if you're really angry. And so no, it's actually not good on you. I'm thinking of the Atlanta campaign, the American Civil War, that Joseph E. Johnston was brilliant, Confederate general, was brilliant at doing a fighting withdrawal. And Jefferson Davis, the president, got sick of him doing a slow withdrawal in front of Atlanta, and he replaced him with John Bell Hood, who was called Fighting John, Fighting Hood, or something like that. And he immediately went on the attack, and his army was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And it was just remarkably stupid all the way around. And so we can talk about effectiveness. We can all the lessons you're saying there work on the larger scale. That's all I'm saying too.
Right, right. Absolutely.
And so let's talk about what if, let's pretend that activists study martial arts and they become proficient at them. What would some of the characteristics of their activism assume? I know that I'm asking you to summarize 20 years in a couple minutes, but
right.
But at least put labels so that people can look forward to experiencing them. Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. And one of the fundamental lessons that I took, especially in the world of Aikido, is the quality of your stance and the quality of your relationship to the world. The word that keeps coming up over and over again is equipoise, where you are standing in the middle of being assertive or retreating, and you're trying to bring that attitude of relationship, that centered approach to other relationships on and off the mat. And if people can learn that even in some small measure, that can go a long way. And so that's the physical metaphor of the spirit that you're trying to bring to your activism and your conflicts outside the dojo.
So that would be your capo. Is what you're saying is that in that position, in that stance or whatever we call it, that one is capable of moving in all directions? Is that part of the point?
Yeah, and that is you have both of those potentials to either enter your opponent's space in an assertive way or to withdraw and lead your opponent and hopefully blend with your opponent motion and then redirect them to some other outcome. So you want to have both those capabilities. And that's a hard thing to teach because we typically have personalities that are shaped by culture. And some of us tend to be very aggressive. We want to encounter, we want to go in, we want to engage, and others want to fall back and retreat. And no, you have to have both of those capabilities in you at all times. That's one of the fundamental messages of a lot of martial art teachings. And it takes a long time to have both of those.
Okay, so we have two lessons here. We have our two attributes that there would be. One would be thinking about effectiveness,
mm-hmm.
and we have that one would be, I believe the term was equipoise.
Yeah.
Okay, so what
or equanimity? Yeah.
What else? What else would you want? Go ahead.
Well, the other one, and this came to me from a martial art teacher, just a little quip that he had during a training, a hand-to-hand training. He said, remember this, the enemy is never wrong. And that one really stuck with me because, of course, on the face of it, the response is, well, of course the enemy is wrong. That's why I'm fighting him. But you think about that more and more. And the message here, the teaching, was that you don't want to get wrapped up in your judgment about what the enemy is doing. You want to release yourself from any expectation and engage the enemy and the enemy's behavior exactly as it's presenting it. So free your mind from that expectation. Remember that the enemy is never wrong, and just deal with whatever the enemy is doing. And that, I thought, was a really powerful teaching because, of course, we get wrapped up in judgment and evaluation. Of course, deforestation is wrong. Of course, industrial fishing is wrong. All of these things, of course, they're wrong. But you got to get past that. You got to relinquish your expectation and just engage the enemy's behavior directly. And that, I think, is a wonderful teaching.
So another way to think about that I mean, when you say, I love it, that's brilliant. And what that made me think of is So somebody is holding a gun on you, or someone, let's make it a knife, so at least you have a better chance. Somebody's holding a knife on you, and they could be doing it because they hate you. They could be doing it because they want to take your wallet. They could be doing it because of all those things. But the truth is, right now, somebody's holding a knife on you, and that's actually the important thing.
Right, right. Because we immediately start to evaluate the experience and say, well, that's wrong for him or her to attack me this way, and that's not normal human behavior, and I won't stand for it, and so on and so forth. But no, you need to let your animal body and your training do the talking here and relinquish your judgment. It's a hard thing to do, but I think it's really important for us as activists to do this now, because if we look at the just the audacity of some of these corporate interests that are destroying the planet, that's easy to get wrapped up in that instead of taking action.
Okay, great. Do you have more of the qualities that we need to assume?
Well, I would pose another question to people, and this comes from an athletic coach that I know, and he always talks to his athletes and says, are you adapted or are you adaptable? And this is a great teaching in the world of martial arts as well, because if you're highly adapted, you are trained to perform really well, and you can function at a high level if conditions never change. And this is what we see in the world of sports, where if you are highly adapted to, say, basketball, you can function at a really high level, but they're never going to change the game of basketball, so you don't have to worry. But if you are in a dynamic environment, being highly adapted then can be a liability. And this is what we look for now, especially now the state of the world is so dynamic and so much in flux that adaptability is probably more important than being adapted. And in fact, being adapted can really be a problem for people. So you have to assume the dynamism of the world and keep adapting. Now, of course, you can do both. My dog Mojo is very adapted to his house and his yard and the trails that he goes on. But if I move to a new location, he's very adaptable and he can do both. So that's kind of an example from the animal world.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And I'm throughout this conversation, I've also been thinking of, you know, like I said, I've been really interested in military history my whole life. And I think there are lessons we can bring from there too. And I'm thinking about a line that Robert E. Lee said that was, somebody asked him why, when he was outnumbered, he so often attacked. And he had a great line, which was, we must weigh the risk of action versus the positive loss of inaction. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if is there a martial arts equivalent to that line?
I'm not sure. I think probably a rereading of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, he would probably have something to say about that. And of course, just the simple element of surprise would be part of that.
Well, there's also the classic line about that sort of the best defense is a good offense.
Right. And just thinking, the difference between thinking offensively or defensively, whether you are engaged in a creative act, the simple question of, are you fighting for something or against something? And that's a question that never comes up because we don't have a martial education. And for all of these so-called activists around the world, that's the question I would put to them in a dojo. I would say, are you fighting for something or against something? And if they haven't taken the time to think about that, then I don't think they've been on the journey, really.
I think that, and we only have a few minutes left, I think that this is all incredibly important. And I'm thinking about, one of the things that frustrated me when I was a baby activist was that so many of the activists, and this didn't frustrate me with the activists, they were doing fine, but they all knew, and this is early 90s, late 80s, they all knew that they were basically they were desperately trying to protect this or that scrap of ground, this or that creature, bull trout, Selkirk, caribou, whomever. And they all knew that they were basically holding on by their fingernails,
yep.
hoping and praying that this creature would last until civilization collapses. And on one hand, that was completely necessary. I mean, you absolutely need, to go back to the military metaphor, you need people to fight to the last man or woman to hold a position waiting for the reinforcements to arrive. That can be absolutely crucial. But at the same time, by itself, that is not a strategy if nobody else is going to arrive. And so this is one of the things that influenced all of my writing since that time profoundly, was seeing all of these people who were privately acknowledging to themselves, you know, I'm just doing a delaying action and I'm doing the best I can until I can hand it off to the next generation. But my point in bringing all this up is I loved what you said about thinking strategically, because they were doing this, but they're, and it was important and it's crucial. I'm not saying anything bad about them,
right.
But at the same time, there was no larger strategy to deal with the fact that of David Brower's line about all of our victories are temporary and our losses are permanent. There was no larger strategy that took that into account, which makes all of us, unless it does collapse, all of us ineffective, ultimately. Ineffective, except that we allowed another few more generations of non-humans to live harried lives before they're ultimately exterminated. And I'm not in any way being negative. I'm simply trying to evaluate our circumstances and develop a strategy that is commensurate with it.
Right. Yeah. And it is such a difficult battle, because it feels like not just David and Goliath, but it's David against an army of Goliaths, you know, and it's easy to lose hope. I think a lot of people are in despair, but what gives me inspiration comes from Chris Hedges, who said, "I don't fight because I think I'm going to win. I fight because it's the right thing to do." And that has been really helpful for me personally. The other place I take a little bit of juice is just thinking longer term. I'm thinking not about survival or preservation during my lifetime anymore. I'm thinking about the seventh generation. What kind of seed can I plant today that is going to help somebody survive in the seventh generation? You know, they're going to need habitat. They're going to need fresh water. What can I do for them? And that helps me. It kind of buffers the despair a little bit. So,
well, and I think that's really important. And I love the buffering the despair, but I think even more importantly, that works toward a strategy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that puts us in the context of a different struggle. And also, I loved what you said about not about the enemy is never wrong. And I completely agree that, yes, of course, the enemy is often wrong. But I totally hear that. And it's like, all you're really saying, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is we need to always, at every moment, be in an embodied fashion analyzing our current circumstances. Okay, here's what I think is it might bring everything together. That at every moment we need to be reevaluating our strategic and our tactical and strategic decisions based on new circumstances and new information, and we need to be able to drop off our judgment and to always be present and balanced such that we can move left, right, back, forward. And that has to be in the service of this larger strategic vision that we are imbued with. Is this a reasonable reflection of what you've been saying?
Yeah, and especially keeping in mind that it's a dynamic environment, and that we're operating with incomplete information, and that the only way to make progress is to keep updating our understanding and to keep evaluating our objectives and to keep learning along the way. I mean, this is martial artistry on a large scale. So, yeah, staying present, staying focused, and keep learning above all.
Which would be a great thing to end on, but we have like 1 minute left. So give us a wrap up.
Oh boy. Well, I guess sort of a fantasy wrap up would be if I ever had the opportunity to start a new dojo, and it would be based on exactly what we've talked about today, where we would have physical training, but in the context of the kind of martial artistry that we would like to be doing out in the world. That would be a really exciting project. So who knows? Maybe one of your listeners will want to engage with that.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah. So thank you again for this conversation. Thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Frank Forensich. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.